Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
In the morning when I woke up, I was amazed because I had 632 mails. They were mostly the same. You Estonian fascists, pigs, you will not live.
Last spring, the tiny Baltic state of Estonia was subjected to an attack unprecedented in world history, an apparent attempt to shut down an entire country by disabling its computers. Estonia and its Western allies blamed what they saw as the neighbourhood bully, Russia.
We were on the edge of disaster, of course. It's a right expression.
By 2007, talk of friendship between Russia and the West was well and truly over. The Kremlin was rowing with America over missiles and with Britain over the poisoning of a Russian dissident in a London hotel. And in Estonia, it seemed, Russia was showing yet again that it would play by its own rules. In this BBC programme, The Bear Unbound, I ask where the new East-West confrontation is leading. History came tapping on Estonia's shoulder last April. An old quarrel with Russia, pursued by the most modern and unexpected of means, a cyber attack.
If you imagine, there are millions of computers who are attacking one single component in your network. The first thing you will think is, what will happen next?
Mihail Tamert of the Estonian Ministry of Defence was first alerted when government websites were defaced by swastikas. Soon, Estonia's whole computer network was deluged with millions of malicious inquiries.
We were on the edge of disaster, of course.
And disaster would have meant?
A disaster would have meant that our bank system would have been out of order for days, and maybe even worse. And that would be a very, very bad scenario.
Today, everything's gone back to normal, but for 90 minutes in May last year, Estonians couldn't even go shopping because the tills wouldn't read the barcodes. It was like a science fiction nightmare, as civil servant Melly Hunt remembers.
When I went to the shop in the evening, there were big supermarkets with tens and tens and tens of people waiting in a queue, and the servers did not respond. So all those bags full of things which people had already picked up were left there because they couldn't pay.
But who would have wanted that? Who was behind it?
Who do you think was organising?
The same people who organised the Bronx Soldier riots, it is quite obvious.
You're fairly clear where all these attacks were coming from.
I have no clue, actually, but these messages were in Russian.
It all started with a statue, and I'm standing in front of that statue now, in the snow, in the military cemetery in Tallinn, the capital of Estonia. It's a statue rather larger than life-size, about 2 metres high, in bronze, of a Russian soldier from the Second World War. His head, very square-jawed, slightly bowed. To most of the ethnic Russians, who make up a quarter of Estonia's population, the monument's a sacred symbol of sacrifice, commemorating the Soviet soldiers who liberated Estonia from the Nazis. But to ethnic Estonians, including the country's head of state, President Tomas Ilves, it's a symbol of slavery.
The Russian troops that came here didn't liberate it, but acted as butchers. They deported hundreds of thousands of people from Eastern Europe. Why we should think of this as a liberation, I don't know. And we certainly don't see it as such.
The bronze soldier used to stand amid the traffic on a city centre square. But by last spring, it was becoming a flashpoint for scuffles between Estonian youths and Russian activists determined to protect it from defacement. The government ordered the statue and the graves of several unknown soldiers alongside it to be moved at dead of night to the cemetery. Several hundred local Russians gathered to protest. When the police tried to disperse them, shops and kiosks were attacked. Roman Yefimov was among the protesters.
People were extremely offended by the decision of the government and the actions of the police, and that's why they wanted to unleash their anger. So they simply began crushing everything they saw, smashing the windows and cars, everything, bus stops, simply chaos.
President Ilves called the rioters criminals, but the Kremlin said it was Estonia that needed punishing. Russia condemned the moving of the statue as blasphemous and inhuman and threatened serious measures in response. Even today, President Putin's adviser, Sergei Prikhodko, can barely contain his fury.
The insult to the memorial can evoke only disgust and incomprehension in any normal person. If anyone admires or supports what they did, I can't understand that. What would your listeners think if a local council in Britain moved a family grave to a more convenient place in a wood somewhere? How would any normal person respond to that?
But Estonia's President Ilves believes the whole dispute was simply an excuse for Russian meddling.
Well, I thought that the active measures of the Russian secret services had managed to pull off a coup. Not a coup d'etat, but rather it had a success.
But what did they succeed in doing?
Well, finally getting the Estonians, who have been rather calm and collected for all these years, to actually fall into reacting to their provocations.
The chief provocateur, President Ilves says, was a Moscow-based youth movement called Nashi, which means our people. What does Roman Yefimov, who belongs to Nashi's Estonian branch, say to that?
I mean, Russia, as I know, was not involved in all this mess.
But the Nashi movement is a movement that supports President Putin. It's a movement that was formed, really, from above,
yes,
by the Kremlin.
Yes, it's true.
So aren't you then, if you're a member of that movement, effectively you must be doing the Kremlin's bidding here in Estonia?
Well, in a way, because mostly Nashi movement, it officially supports Russians here in Estonia.
But you helped to bring people to this demonstration?
No, of course not. Everyone who came here, they did it by their own will.
The protesters came, he believes, because moving the statue was a further insult to local Russians after years of discrimination. Regarded as occupiers or the children of occupiers, many are stateless because they can't or won't pass an Estonian language exam. But even though Russia and Estonia used to belong to the same country, their leaders haven't been talking much about that or anything else, as President Ilves tells me. Have you ever discussed this with President Putin?
No, he doesn't really care about Estonia. I mean, to give you an example, when the only time the Russian Prime Minister has been to Estonia, he came for, there was an international meeting of prime ministers. And he didn't have time to meet the Prime Minister of Estonia. He went fishing instead. But in fact, you know, it doesn't really bother us. I mean, our whole goal is to reintegrate ourselves as quickly and as much as possible into Europe and get away from that sort of Byzantine world that we were forced to live in for 50 years. I mean, we're a very small part of a much larger thing, which is the whole Russian attitude towards the West. It's this bizarre attitude. I mean, this nostalgia for great power status and respect based on fear. And you hear day in and day out that we will not play by the Western rules. They are not going to tell us what democracy is. We have our own concept of democracy. That includes a controlled press and denied access to opposition candidates and beating them up and all of these other things. I mean, it really is to exaggerate to say turn our back, but I would say that the engagement should really be in those areas where it is of interest to the European Union, but not broader than that.
That attitude's gaining ground. The switch off of gas to Ukraine, the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko in London, and the bronze soldier dispute have convinced many Europeans that they should gird up for a milder version of the old Cold War. Meanwhile, in Russia, you could get the impression that that war's already being refought as a tide of officially inspired nationalism sweeps the country. This expensively produced and very partisan video of the bronze soldier riots was made for a Russian audience. It reminds me of the anti-Western propaganda I used to see in the old Soviet Union, as do President Putin's complaints about Western interference. We must step up our efforts to get timely information about attempts to meddle in our internal affairs, he told leaders of Russia's intelligence agency recently, and warned that they mustn't allow the current presidential election campaign to be affected by foreigners. Increasingly now, any foreigners trying to promote democracy are viewed as enemies who don't respect Russia's sovereignty. British Ambassador Sir Anthony Brenton found himself hounded by the youth movement Nashi for daring to address an opposition gathering.
They sort of camped out outside my house. They followed me around town, whether I travelled by car or whether I walked. One famous occasion when I went out to the supermarket to buy cat food, they followed me all the way down there waving banners and things to the deep bemusement of the sales girl in the supermarket. I regularly attend and speak at meetings, and they used to break into those meetings and try and break them up and shout slogans and things.
What makes you think that that was not spontaneous?
I have no proof that it wasn't spontaneous, but they did have very good understanding of my movements. They had remarkable technical ability to follow me around Moscow through the not very easy to manage Moscow traffic. I did on one or two occasions see them able to get on the phone to someone and, on the basis of whoever it was they were talking to, persuade the police to let them into the meetings. So there's quite a lot of circumstantial evidence that they had friends who could help them deal with the authorities at the minimum.
And at the maximum, I mean, do you think we're talking about a Kremlin-inspired campaign?
I simply don't know. This is a difficult country to decipher in some ways.
Russia's political system is still so opaque that evidence against the Kremlin is nearly always circumstantial. There's no proof of its involvement in the Estonian riots, for example, or in the cyber attacks. And the opportunities for mischief afforded by that lack of transparency are what convinces many in the West that world stability depends on Russia becoming more democratic. US Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Fried.
We want to see a strong Russia as a partner. But strong Russia doesn't mean strong, hopefully, in the ways Tsarist Russia was traditionally strong or Soviet Russia was traditionally strong. A strong nation to be a partner needs strong institutions and suitable to the 21st century. You know, a strong state needs a strong opposition, a strong free press, independent institutions, the rule of law. Those are the elements that make for good partners in the world.
And it's Britain, that cradle of democracy, that's now insisting most vehemently that Russia play by Western rules.
Order. Statement, Secretary Miliband.
Foreign Secretary David Miliband called to address the House of Commons last July after Russia failed to hand over the chief suspect in the Litvinenko murder case, Andrei Lugovoy.
Mr. Speaker, with your permission, I'd like to make a statement on developments in the Litvinenko case. This is a situation the government has not sought and does not welcome.
Britain, he tells me, had to stand up for its values.
Murder is the most serious crime. And it was the brutal murder of a British citizen. And we felt it was essential that we follow through the integrity of our judicial and prosecution processes. And the refusal of the Russian government to cooperate in the extradition of Lugovoy was very, very serious.
First, we will expel four diplomats from the Russian embassy in London. Second, we shall review the extent of our cooperation with Russia on a range of issues. And as an initial step, we have suspended...
Russia's response has been slow but sure. 6 months later, it demanded the closure of the regional offices of the British government's cultural organisation, the British Council. That day, I went to see Russia's Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. The Kremlin's action, he told the BBC, was retaliation, pure and simple.
The British government undertook some actions which inflicted what I would call systemic damage to our relations. And absolutely unrealistic and illegitimate request to extradite Lugovoy. So we have to retaliate. And this retaliation was made just like any country which respects itself would do in a similar situation.
Well, here on the snowy forecourt of the Foreign Ministry building, just as I've come out, I can see in front of me there's a large black 4x4 flying the Union flag that obviously belongs to the British ambassador here. And he's just gone into the building, I'm told, to talk about the restrictions that have been placed on the British Council. I'm going to wait till he's come out to see what he's got to say. I wait in a car till a grim Sir Anthony Brenton emerges.
Is it possible that? Let's go and have a word with him.
Let's go and have a word with him.
Reporters are waiting to hear his reaction.
Some way to the measures we took following the murder of Alexander Litvinenko. And in particular, in our view, they do not have an answer to the clear fact that what they're planning to do is illegal.
So what will be the actions of the British side now? Will the embassy will be closed?
As I say, we remain hopeful that the Russians will reconsider.
2 months on, the Russians haven't reconsidered. Perhaps Foreign Secretary David Miliband broke one of the first rules of diplomacy by picking a fight he couldn't win.
You used the word reprehensible. Do you regret now being quite so strong? Some people said that was undiplomatic.
No, I think it's very, very important that diplomacy isn't conducted in code. Diplomacy needs to be conducted in language that people understand. And I think that across the international community, there was astonishment at the Russians taking action against a cultural organisation like the British Council that operates in over 110 countries in the world. It's very, very important, actually, that we don't get trapped by the history of this, because the temptations of spending our time discussing how we've done over the last 10 years will actually obscure how we go forward from here. And what's clear about the world of 2008 is that there is even more that binds Russia and the West together than 10 years ago.
What binds them, above all, is business. Pumped up by petrodollars, Russia's now rich. And many in the West realise that an over-insistence on exporting values may damage other forms of trade. But does Russia also risk damaging its own interests by an over-insistence on respect? It was offended by Estonia, offended by Britain, offended even by its small southern neighbour Georgia, which expelled Russian diplomats after accusing them of spying. The tension between the two countries has even led to a ban on Georgian wine, once a market leader in Russia. Georgians in Moscow are dismayed.
It's Russian politics. As wine is a very good product in Georgia, and you cannot buy in Russia's markets. It's impossible.
And what do you think about that?
I think that's...
Because Georgians are very proud of their wine, yes?
Yes, Georgians have very good wine, and I am Georgian, I want to drink here.
When I meet President Putin's advisor, Sergei Prikhodka, I want to know how shutting out Georgia's main export will help the Kremlin regain influence there. Wouldn't Russia become stronger by making itself more attractive to its neighbours? His answer shocks me.
We'll use those methods which are in the interest of the Russian state and the law. Georgia can't be like a little boy who takes a knife or a hammer and tries to whack his neighbour as painfully as he can. You can't behave like that. Even a small child knows if you spill tea or mess up your bed, you might be punished. According to different traditions, you might get a slap, or you might get a real beating.
It's a hard attitude.
Well, I ask your listeners, when it comes to bringing up children, who respects hooliganism and disobedience, and who punishes it?
It seems obvious to me that punishing other countries may simply send them running ever faster from Russia's embrace. But the Kremlin, apparently, hasn't learnt that lesson. Daniel Fried of the American State Department.
Russia regards itself as having emerged from the period of weakness, of national weakness in the 1990s, and many Russians believe that their country is, quote, back. Our view is we're glad that Russia's more self-confident. But confidence to what end? What will Russia do with this wealth, with the self-confidence? Will it be a good neighbor and a good actor in the world, or will it revert to some of the bad habits of the past?
But for the Kremlin, that kind of moralizing is one of the West's worst habits. In fact, America and Europe must decide too. Will they treat Russia as an economic powerhouse whose help they need with many problems, Kosovo, Iran, terrorism, climate change, or as a paranoid autocracy whose sensitivities are irrational? Sergei Prikhodka, President Putin's foreign policy adviser, tells the BBC that respect must come first.
We need one thing, understanding and respect, so that the interests of the Russian Federation, her history, culture and constitution are treated with the same respect as we treat our partners.
That's what didn't happen before.
Of course it existed during the Cold War, when the world was balanced, when we lived in confrontation with the threat of mutual destruction. Well, I don't know whether the Soviet Union was respected or whether it was feared or hated. That's a question for you to answer. We had different values. Today we are not confronting each other, I hope, although many are provoking us to that.
Indeed, there's talk all around of a new Cold War, as both sides revert to old stereotypes. The rhetoric doesn't fit easily with the reality of millions of Russians visiting and doing business in the West, and increased contacts in many non-political fields. But when there's no trust at the top, rhetoric can acquire a life of its own. And right now, in an East-West relationship still crucial to world stability, trust is at a minimum.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.